Good morning, everyone. Can you give the talk? Actually, I have to say that I just want people to relax, because I know that quite a lot of people are here because they are concerned either about themselves or a friend or relative who has perhaps been a bit more forgetful in the last few weeks. Last few months. Hands up if you know anybody like that. Or everybody's hands going up. Well, I just wanted to say right at the very beginning that we're all in this together. And though I'm going to be telling you a bit about our work at Lancaster University and other work to deal with this very serious problem, I want you to realize that we're all in this together. Why do I say that? Well, Claire, who's my PhD student, and I were at a conference in Windermere this week. I was away for 2-3 days. This was the view at the top out of my bedroom. We stayed at the Lowood Hotel. Anybody know where that is? Fantastic hotel, great breakfast, fantastic bathroom, huge bathroom with a fire in the bathroom. So I took a photograph. I'd never had a coal fire in a bathroom. And there was this lovely little welcome present here, asking, I had to pay £15 if I wanted to take it for a walk and give the money to charity. But while I was there, I discovered on arrival I hadn't got my wallet. I could not find my wallet. I searched high and low and it was missing. I eventually rang my daughter and somebody said, try this trick, it will work. Because I was in Windermere, she's in Preston. Bribe her. Tell her you're taking her out for lunch and tell her to look around the house, because you must have left it there, to bring your wallet up, and then you'll take her out for lunch. So got her she looked around the house. She couldn't find it. We had lunch. She brought a few other things that I forgot, like socks. And at the end of the conference, after massive searches high and low, I found the wallet in the front of my rucksack. So if you're worried about memory, you're in very good company. We're all in this together. This presentation, which I've got a lot I could share with you, and obviously I can't cover everything that I would like to cover in the time we've got, but I want to just give you a feel of the problem and some of the work that we've been doing at Lancaster University to try and help. And given this, the question I'm starting with is, why should we all be in the fight to help why should we all help in the fight against Alzheimer's disease? There's a lot of fear, there's a lot of worry, there's a lot of concern. It's in the media every week of some aspect of Alzheimer's disease. However, what I'd like to perhaps end today with is giving us all a sense that we're not powerless and there are things that we can all do to try to help. We've been doing some research, which I'll tell you a little bit about, in hospitals in Lancaster and Blackburn and also in care homes. I'll tell you a little bit more about that at the end. So where are we going to go in the next sort of 45 minutes to an hour? I want to start off by giving a sort of overview, background on Alzheimer's disease. I'll tell you a little bit about why this technique that we've been using for so many years, using special cameras to monitor the eyes, why that might be relevant and useful in the future. I'm going to tell you about... This is the sciencey bit, and some of you might want to fall asleep during this bit. This will be the commercial break. I'm going to tell you about some hard evidence that we've gathered over the last 10 years that we think supports the research that we've been doing. And then I will talk about some signs of hope that I detect for the future with regards to Alzheimer's disease, and then just briefly end up with some thoughts about how we can all help in this work. I'm grateful to a friend of mine at this church, a consultant, who gave me this slide. This is a slide which, if you can read it, I'm not sure you can, but I'll help you walk through it. It indicates the average age life expectancy for individuals at different times in history. So in way, way back in the Upper Paleolithic era, the average age of a person who was born at that time would be 33. If you lived beyond 33, you were doing extremely well. In the classical Rome period, the average age went down a bit to 28. Medieval Britain, coming a bit further forward, the average age was 30. Even in the early 20th century, some of us can remember that period, the average age, because of probably a lot of childbirths, stillbirths and deaths in childhood, was still only 31. And it's only relatively recently across the world that we see an increase in the average age. This is the average that people lived. You can see it's almost doubled in a very short period of time. What does that mean for us? Well, during this period where people died before they were 35, diseases of the old age didn't exist. You didn't have things like Parkinson's disease, or it was extremely rare, or these other diseases of the old, because the majority of people died well before that, that would have happened. But now, things have completely changed. And that's why we're seeing, one of the reasons we're seeing things like dementia almost in epidemic proportions in certain parts of the world. So here's some figures about Alzheimer's disease that you may, and dementia you may have seen in the media. We have about nearly a million, we're nearly approaching the million mark of people with dementia in the UK. And certainly very soon, by 2021, we're going to have at least a million. One in three people over 65 apparently will die with some kind of dementia. We're getting 163,000 cases a day, and it's costing the economy, in terms of lost income and care costs, which I'm sure you're aware of, a huge amount of money, $23 billion at least, and that may well be an underestimate. So it's a big issue, and that's why David Cameron, Obama, Sarkozy have all got together and G8 and are trying to tackle this, because if we don't tackle this problem, it's going to cripple the country, Western countries, at least economically, if this continues. We have to do something to get to grips with it. And that's why David Cameron launched the Dementia Challenge, and he's actually right behind the work. So it's a big problem. One of the questions that people always get confused about, and they like to ask, is what is the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? What is, what's dementia, what's Alzheimer's disease? Well, very simply, dementia is an umbrella term that encompasses lots of other disorders that produce cognitive impairment, memory, thinking disease. And Alzheimer's is just one of those. Okay? So dementia is the overarching category, and there are various diseases that can result in a dementia. The reason why people focus so much on Alzheimer's disease is because it accounts for the largest proportion of older people with dementia. Okay? About 50% of people who have a dementia have it because of Alzheimer's disease. But you may know of relatives who've had, say, a vascular dementia or Lewy body dementia, or some of these other causes, which include Parkinson's disease. But they account for relatively small amounts of the population that have dementia. So the big guy, if you like, here is Alzheimer's disease. I'm just going to give you, I'm looking around here, do we have any young people who might not have come across dementia here? These are just some of the cognitive features. If you've never seen a person with a dementia, these are some of the things that go wrong in the brain of somebody with a dementia and Alzheimer's. So the thing that most people think about, if this was a question and answer session, the thing that most people think about is a loss of memory. You become more forgetful, particularly short-term memory. So you forget where you lose... where you've put your keys. John, don't say anything. You forget what kind of petrol to put in your car, whether it should be diesel or or petrol. You tend not to forget, for example, when you were born or your own birthday. It's more sort of short-term things in the early stages. Aphasia, this is difficulty. Some people with a dementia have difficulty with words and names. They forget, I'm getting like this, they forget the names of their students, they forget the name of their kids. Apraxia is another problem that can occur, and that's, could you imagine this, and I won't mention it, what it must be like to forget how to make a cup of tea if you're a tea fan. It must be really, really difficult. Something really highly practiced, or to get dressed. That would be an apraxia, forgetting how to do well-learned tasks, or playing golf, or whatever is your passion. Agnosia is a very unpleasant one. I remember some years ago when I was in the Liver Memory Clinic, and it was one of the early stages where memory clinics were just getting started, and I saw a patient come in with his wife, and the most distressing aspect of his symptoms was that when his children had retired and they used to ring up and just for a chat, and he'd forgotten their names. He couldn't remember his own children's names. I heard another very tragic case. I met this lady at a conference, and her mother ended up with a dementia. And it can be so cruel and so selective. I mean, it might be simple if everything went, but in her case, what happened was her mother forgot her name, but remembered the name and the face of her husband and the other daughter, but for some reason could remember her name. And obviously that was incredibly painful to deal with. So these problems can be really, really painful. What's the biggest risk factor? The biggest risk factor is what I started with at the end. It's simply the fact that we get old. If we could turn that biological clock off, anybody got any good ideas how we can do that? We would sort the problem out. Aging is, this is a disorder of aging. So it's very different, for example, like for schizophrenia. Schizophrenia is a disorder of young people. You tend to get it before you're 25. Alzheimer's disease and dementia is at the other end. It's a neurodegenerative disorder. So you get it in old age. And that's why we've got the worries across Western societies. The figures that we have here are that dementia affects 1 in 14 people over 65 and 1 in 6 over 80. Now, that might sound, if we've got, you know, every sixth person here, when you get over 80, the probability is that, I don't know how many people we've got here, maybe 20 of you will end up with some kind of dementia, according to this statistics. But the other way to look at this is to turn it on its head and say, well, actually, in every six people, five of you won't. Which five will it be? Now, unfortunately, the clinical approach of most people is to focus on the one. And say it's unfortunate, the one in six. So a lot of research is focusing just on the one. What goes wrong? What can we do for the one in six? Very little research is focused on what is keeping the five in six healthy. Because if we could work out why five in six people, what they're doing right, we could maybe help the one in six. Do you see what I'm getting at? But a lot of the funding, so if you try to get funding from the Medical Research Council or some money for, you say, I want to look at healthy people, they'll not be interested. If you say, I want to look at the one in six who gets Alzheimer's, so they suddenly wake up and they're interested. But nobody's funding work to do the five in six, which is a shame. So, I mean, wouldn't it be fantastic if at the age of 30 or 35, we had the equivalent of a mental MOT test? You know, every year, those of us who are drivers, we have an MOT. We're not allowed to drive. Anybody drive without having an MOT? You're not allowed to do that, are you? Wouldn't it be great if from the age of about 30, we could have a mental MOT test, which would predict, well, tell us how we're doing. So do you need to spend more time doing crosswords and playing chess rather than watching X Factor? You know, do you need to go do a bit more exercise? Because these are things that protect you. It'd be great if we could have that sort of MOT test. And we might actually be getting there. the good news is we might be on our way to that point. Okay, at this point, what I want to do, and I won't charge you for this, I'm going to give you a group dementia test, okay? So you will be able to find out how you're doing, whether you need further follow-ups, okay? So, as I said before, that, you know, there were not many older people around, but actually, way back in Aristotle's and Homer's time, there was a description of a few people that had what he called feebleness of mind. But one of the things, one of the clues, if you like, as to what the cause might be, is this. It doesn't seem to matter what society, what culture you're in, what social economic bracket you are, whether you're upper class, middle class, you are still vulnerable to Alzheimer's disease. It's nothing to do with things like socioeconomic status. So now we're going to do the diagnosis, the early diagnosis for dementia for the over 40s. So if you're under 40, you've no chance. You're going to fail this, but don't worry. So does anybody recognize this guy? You probably need to be over 40. Perry, well done. I thought you had dementia, but clearly, clearly John is fine. That's Perry Como. Perry Como died in 2001 with Alzheimer's disease. He's a very, who was he? What did he do? He was a famous singer. And in those days, famous singers always wore those nice cardigans and jackets, didn't they? At Val Dunican. How about this guy? Columbo. Can I have his proper name, please? Peter Falk. Yeah, I can tell the ones who grew up watching television, didn't you? Television addict. So Peter Falk, he also died with Alzheimer's disease, sadly, not too long ago, 2011. How about this chap? You can see the real television. Charlton Heston. He was a famous actor, wasn't he? I don't think I've seen any films of his, but... Sorry? Ben-Hur. You've seen it? I'm sure you're way, way too young for Charlton Heston. What was his other claim to fame, by the way? Because I gave this talk at Glasgow at an optician's, and somebody shouted out something else about him. Does anybody know anything about him? Yes. He was president... Who's that? President of the gun lobby in the States. So that may... I don't know whether I should change your view of him. But he's a pro-gun, very much pro-gun. But he died of Alzheimer's. If you don't recognize him, please see me afterwards. I need to see him. This is obviously Ronald Reagan, again. Now we're getting into something in common. What is common in this next series of people? So this is president of the most powerful country in the world, has access to the best healthcare. It wasn't sufficient to help him. He died of Alzheimer's in 2005. Many people said actually they would have been able to diagnose it much earlier than that from his speeches, but we won't go there. Two of our recent prime ministers also died with Alzheimer's disease. Does anybody not recognize, particularly that lady on the right? Nobody's prepared to admit. Yep, Margaret Thatcher, if you see, also went. Harold Wilson died, I think, in 1995. So I think we've got a reasonably healthy congregation here. More recently, did you pick this up, that Timothy West and Pranala Skelton... Timothy West, I think, is fine, but he's heartbroken because his wife, Pranala Skelton, has been showing signs recently of mild Alzheimer's disease. So the point I'm making there is these stories get in the media when very well-known people get it, but it is the case that it doesn't matter what strata of society you're in, you can be affected. And of course, you know, when your mum and dad get it, or whatever relative gets it, the media's not interested, but it's just as painful, it's just as sad when anybody gets this disorder. Okay, a bit more background information. Another question people often ask is, does it affect young people? Or if my dad has it, or my grandma, am I likely to get it? Well, strictly speaking, you can get Alzheimer's disease at a young age, but it's rare. So apparently 5% of Alzheimer's victims get the symptoms in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. So 95% of people get it when they're much older. There is a rare type. If you get it before 65, it's called early onset dementia. It's very rare, and it's considered to be more likely to be familial than if you're getting older. So if you have Alzheimer's disease, if you've know somebody with Alzheimer's who's had it in their old age, that is extremely unlikely to be familial. In other words, there's not a gene it's not genetically transmitted to you when you get older disease. So if your parents have it, your auntie has it, it doesn't increase the chances that you'll get late onset Alzheimer's disease. But if you have it at an earlier age, there's a slight increase in the chance that you may be at higher risk, and this is all risk. So it's nothing to worry about too much. Now, this is the person. You might wonder, why do we call it such a strange name? Why don't we keep the old name, like, you know, presenile dementia or whatever it is? It's called Alzheimer's disease because this chap here, this German scientist doctor, was the first person to describe the hallmarks, the pathological hallmarks, and there are two of them. So just incidentally, the medics here might not find this strange, but everybody else in the world seems to find it strange that when, as a mark of honor in medicine, if you have a disease named after you, that is considered to be a really fantastic achievement. So if in a few years' time you hear of something called Crawford's disease, that means I've made it, okay? It's supposed to be a mark of honor. Other of us would think, well, that's rather odd. Why would you want a disease named after you? But that's how it works in medicine, apparently. So he discovered in a 51-year-old, so that's relatively young. You would describe that as young onset. When she died, this person obviously had dementia and was losing her memory and the rest of it. He was able to identify pathologically two hallmarks. These, what he called mirrory bodies, which I'll show you a picture of, which we refer often as senile plaques, were discovered, and these fibrils. So this gives you a sort of better idea. This is a sort of healthy cartoon, if you like, of a healthy brain showing nerve fibers and a cell body here. What Alzheimer's described, and this is still the case, this is the definitive, is that you get two pathologies. You get an increase in these extracellular, so they're outside the cell, plaques, beta amyloid plaques. And within the nerve fibers, you get these twisted neurofibrillar tangles that affect the transport system within the neuron. So the nerves get hit from two directions. They get hit from toxic processes that occur extracellularly outside each cell, and they get attacked by twisted nerve tangles within the cell. And there are scientists, particularly some colleagues of mine, who have spent years of their lives trying to inhibit the buildup of these. If we could stop these beta amyloid plaques aggregating, tangling together, we may be able to cure the problem. And there's a lot of work that's going on at targeting these, and other drugs are being developed to try and deal with a problem that's happening within the cell. We can see some of the later end products of these tangles and these plaques, the damage that they do on MRI scans. So here's a healthy brain, here's a brain with Alzheimer's disease. All you need to see is that there's an increase in the sort of spaces here, if you like, these sulci in the brain, showing that cells are dying, brain cells are dying as a result of these toxic processes I have just talked about. So you can see that later on in Alzheimer's disease. You can also measure the buildup of this beta amyloid stuff now. We've now got ligands, and we can use what are called positron emission tomography brain scans to identify the buildup of this stuff in various parts of the brain. So here's an Alzheimer's brain showing lots in red areas here, lots of this toxic stuff, this beta amyloid. And here's a healthy brain showing hardly any at all. So we can measure that as well. So we can use brain imaging to identify this stuff, this horrible stuff that causes damage. And you can also, if you obviously take a brain biopsy, cut into the brain, you can actually directly stain and identify the beta amyloid plaques and the tangles. So what's the problem? Why then is it that it is so difficult to sometimes diagnose before it's too late? So the problem is that these techniques are not feasible for widespread use. So it's not feasible to have a positron emission tomography scanner in every local hospital to measure beta amyloid in the brain. You need a cyclotron. It's very, very expensive. You and I would not like to have a lumbar puncture every time we forget where our keys are to check we've got Alzheimer's disease. Nobody would really want that. It's not feasible. These techniques are not, and the brain scan, the CT scan, they are not sensitive, and the MRI scans don't often show anything up in the early stages. So these tests that we've got available just are not very feasible. And they're certainly not feasible if you're interested in developing countries where we're going to have a problem in a few years. So the other worrying thing, before we all leave, is that it's now thought that these problems that build up in this beta amyloid actually starts many, many years, some up to 20 to 30 years before you get the symptoms. So by the time these brain scans start showing up effects, the process is already underway, and it's difficult to reverse. And one of the problems that you may, I don't know if you've got relatives who are on medication, the medication only works at present for a temporary period, sadly, at the moment, because it probably has been started way too late in the process. By the time they've detected the problem, the brain has lost billions of cells. And once you've lost them, they're difficult to repair or find. So what do we need? We need something that can pick up the problem way, way, way earlier, and then we can sort of do what we can to kind of reverse it. So one of the aims of our research is to try and pick up things a lot, lot earlier. A lot of psychological tests, you may have heard of some of the psychological tests that people do. They focus on the memory side. As I said, that's one of the key symptoms. But it's probably the case that actually by the time you and I start forgetting where stuff is, again, it's probably too late. We probably need that MOT much earlier than that, as early as possible. So the earlier we can pick problems up, the better. The problem is also there because we don't currently have very good psychological tests for picking up Alzheimer's disease at an early stage. Some of the tests we do, if I was cruel, I could get somebody up, couldn't I, and sort of demonstrate the tests. Some of the tests that we have are very, very good if you've been, you're highly educated, you've been a professional. But if you've had a sort of not very much, you left school at 16, you may fail the test, not because you've got Alzheimer's disease, but actually you never knew those words, long words, in the first place. My mum actually had dementia, and she sadly passed away early this year. And I was there when they did this mini mental test on her, and she failed years ago. And when we were talking to her friends, when we came out, we thought she would have failed those tests at 25. She never knew that stuff at 25. It was just totally inappropriate stuff. And sadly, we don't have available many tests that are suitable across the board. So we certainly need more research, and that's one of the reasons we're doing the work that we're doing. So here's a little graph that charts how our thinking skills, our cognitive skills change. As you get older, I am afraid it's inevitable you will get a little bit worse at a lot of things. Sadly, some things, don't believe the story, by the way, that you get worse at everything as you get old. As people are doing more research, they're finding things like, if you define it, wisdom, actually does not decline. So older people tend to be, if you want to define it, wiser than younger people. That's relatively present. Also, verbal skills, verbal ability, knowledge of words doesn't decline. But generally speaking, a lot of things get slower. The trajectory that people follow, however, if they're going to on the road to Alzheimer's, is this one here. So they start off okay, and then things start to rapidly decline, especially towards the end. And what we want to do in our research is try to find out who is on, as early as possible, who is okay and on this road and needs to continue as they are, and who's on this road and we need to do things here. And just to cut to the chase, the kind of things that people are strongly recommending, if you want to know how best to do, if you're here, the kind of things that you should be thinking about are looking at your diet carefully, but the big one is exercise, okay? So cardiovascular exercise. So tomorrow morning, I want to see you all out going for runs down Preston. But if you knew, if you seriously knew which of these roads you want, you would take it seriously, wouldn't you? You wouldn't worry. Is Alzheimer's disease going viral? Somewhere in the world, sadly, someone is developing Alzheimer's disease every 7 seconds. So how long have I been speaking? 35 minutes. How many people have had Alzheimer's disease in that time? Scary, isn't it? Japan. I was talking to somebody who spent some time. Japan's a fascinating country, by the way. Fascinating place. It has the highest proportion of elderly people in the world. For some reason, people live to an older age in Japan than anywhere else. I don't know what it is. Is it the sushi? I don't know what it is. So more than 20%, and this slide is out, more than 20% of the people in Japan are over 65. And by 25, it's, so Japan, not only have they had these horrible earthquakes, they're going to have a terrible problem with neurodegenerative disorders. They're going to have a huge increase in Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease if something's not done. But it's not just Japan, and I'm sorry if you can't read this, but even in so-called, let's get the technical word, is it developing countries? Am I saying that? Developing countries. As the aging, the average age increases, they're going to see problems on a scale they've never seen before. So this is not a problem just for Preston or Lancaster or Leeds. It's a problem across the globe. Okay? So we urgently need better tests so we can pick people up early and help early. And we need valid tests, not tests that people are going to fail just because they come from a different culture or they've left school at an earlier age. So that's one of the reasons we are doing our work at Lancaster. So we have a group at Lancaster called the Center for Aging Research, and the director is Christine Mulligan, very nice lady. She's doing some very interesting work with people with dementia. And what she's trying to do is, it's almost a win-win thing. She's trying to boost the self-esteem of people with dementia and also help with learning. So what she does is, I said before, many people with early dementia can still remember lots of things about the past. So what she's done is, in history lessons, she's taken people with dementia into the classroom. She's doing one-to-one sessions with the patients and the children. The so-called patients or clients still remember brilliantly what it was like in the war and can give first-hand information. And the kids are hearing first-hand what it was like during this historically from somebody who was actually, their parents lived through it or they lived through it. So the kids are loving it. The people with dementia feel fantastically wonderful and of value to society. Because rather than focusing on what they haven't got, what they have is being preserved and used. And they come away feeling really, really boosted. which probably slows down their overall impairment. Because rather than sitting at home or sitting at home doing nothing, they're in schools helping children learn. So that's some of the work she's doing. But David Alsup is probably the star of the show. He's actually working on those beta amyloid plaques and trying to develop chemicals to break them down. And he's had a lot of success. He's actually one of the person who made one of the most important discoveries about Alzheimer's disease and discovered what's called the beta amyloid cascader hypothesis. Jane Simpson, I work with her a lot. She works on Parkinson's disease. And then there's a younger version of your speaker. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I've been doing. So my work has been to use our eyes to try and develop eye tests that may be useful in diagnosis. So the things about the eyes is that the brain controls how your eyes move. And everybody can move their eyes. So it doesn't matter whether you left school at 14, 16, or 22. You can still move your eyes. It doesn't matter whether you live in China, Bangkok, Turkey, New York, or London, or Preston. You can still move your eyes. So if we can develop tests that with the eyes, we may be able to develop something that's more useful. And that's what we've been doing. It's taken a long, long time. It may sound, when I show you the research, you might think, did it take you all that time to do that? I could have done that in 5 minutes. It's taken us a long, long time to, if you like, prove the value of this research. But I just want to tell you a sort of experience I had with it. We published some results of our research on developing new eye tests in 2005. And I got terribly excited. And the university said, if you've got some new exciting results, tell us about it and we'll tell the world. So in 2005, I told the university about it. They sent the information out there. And the Lancashire Evening Post picked it up. And they wrote a little story about it, which I was really proud of. They called me at home and I did an interview in my pajamas in my bedroom, which you can do because nobody, you're on radio. So I had an interview on Bay Road. And that was it. That was the extent of the interest. That was in 2005. In 2012, we published, this is the team here, some very similar results about the potential value of eye tests for diagnosing dementia and Parkinson's disease. And so I did the same thing again. I sent the information out, and I was expecting, you know, maybe the Lancashire Evening Post to show a bit of interest. But the very next day, it started appearing, without me knowing, because nobody, they never ask you this, all over the place. So the Daily Mail reported it, the Daily Telegraph reported it. The Daily Express, the next day, do you remember the time when Harry was on the front page because he'd pulled his trousers down in America? Do you remember that? Do you remember that? Does nobody remember that? He pulled his trousers down and somebody took photos. So they pushed that story into the corner and they put our research on front page of the Daily Express. I was not asked for permission. This just completely blew me away. I wasn't expecting this. And the EU sort of got the story and put it on one of their web pages and so on. But this really shocked me because what we've got, the Pakistan Observer reported, the Indy Gazette. I haven't shown the Jamaican Gazette, where my parents could, that's what would have really made it proud of me. The Jamaican Gazette reported it, South Asian News. So there were about the Indian Express. There were, the Times of India is the biggest circulating newspaper in the world. They reported this result. Eye tests may detect Alzheimer's disease. It was like a plague. I didn't exactly have people camping outside my door for my autograph, but never mind. So Why in 2005 was the furthest interest we got was the Lancashire Evening Post, but in 2012 we get a wide interest across the world. And I think part of it is this, in that time period, people had begun to get really concerned, and there's a desperate, desperate hunger out there for something that's going to help with the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease and help across the globe, which is possibly why India, the Indian and the Pakistan Gazette pick it up, because they want something that can be valid and useful, not just in Preston and Lancashire, but also in Hyderabad or wherever. So what we do, and I will brush over this, we use a very, very good but expensive set of cameras to record where your eyes are. And we give people certain tasks to do. But these tasks are graded in difficulty. Some are simple, that everybody can do, and I mean everybody, and some are a little bit more difficult that take that require a bit more thinking. And it's the thinking task that we found have been very helpful. So I'm going to brush on, actually, because I don't want to overrun. So when you, just to tell you a little bit about these eye movements here, when you read, and I know a lot of people read, you don't look at every single letter on the page. That would take you forever. What you do is your eyes jump from word to word, and they jump to specific parts of the word. So here's an example here. This is the eye looking at a particular word. So, and the reason why we do that is because our eyes only see in detail at a particular point where you're looking. So you need to move your eyes around to see clearly. My son should be here. Your eyes are actually controlled by three pairs of muscles. So each eye is controlled by six muscles. So actually, if you want to do a bit of exercise and not leave your bedroom or your couch, you can just move your eyes around. I don't mind, keep fit for today. Because they expend energy in, so there's a pair of muscles that move your eyes from side to side, pair that move up to down, and the pair that do this sort of thing, does torsion. But that's at the very low level. At a higher level, a second level, their eyes are controlled by lower parts of the brain, the brainstem, but they're also controlled at a higher level, and this is the three-level process. They're controlled by parts of the brain that are affected by our thinking ability, and also which are affected by Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's. So some of the tests we use are looking not at the control of the muscles, but looking at the parts of this network, this brain network that's controlling your eyes. So I can give you a test, and I can ask you to do certain things, and I can tell to a certain extent which parts of this network may or may not be working. At least I can infer, have a reasonable guess. So I have a diagnostic tool that doesn't involve me taking any blood samples, doesn't involve you sitting in a scanner. It simply involves people sitting in front of a computer and me putting a very high precision camera in front of them, monitoring their eyes, and I can measure brain activity. It's very cheap, it's transportable, it can be done anywhere in the world. So I think that might explain why there was quite a lot of interest in this this technique. So, am I going backwards? Okay. So, very briefly, I want to tell you, about our research, and then go on to say what we can do to help. The research that we've done focused on three questions. Can these tests help us detect dementia in Alzheimer's? Can the tests provide a measure of severity? And can the tests distinguish between effects of just aging, who's on the normal pathway of aging, and who's on the pathway to Alzheimer's disease? So this is where some of you might want to go to sleep because it gets a little bit technical, and I'll wake you up when we get to the commercial. So is somebody asleep at the back, actually? So what we did in this research was we compared people with... I have to tell you, by the way, this research was not funded by big funders. This research was funded by friends of Lytham Hospital. So several years ago, what we did was we went to Lytham Hospital, where there were some doctors, and me and David Alsop wished to meet with these volunteers, just normal people like you, and we told them what we wanted to do. And they said, have you got any funding to do it? And we said, no. And they said, okay, we've got a bit of funding from garden parties that we use to support the hospital. We've never supported research before. We will support a researcher to do research to help you do this. So all this research that you're seeing here has come from ordinary people digging into their own pockets in garden parties and funding a researcher. So that's how the funding came about. This is an eye tracker that lots of these older people, kindly, you will not believe it. If you ask people nicely, it's amazing what they will do for you. But older people agreed to wear that camera so we could record their eyes. That's an old version of the system. We did lots of tests on people. So we did computer tests, we did pen and paper, pencil tests, because we wanted to compare our eye tests with traditional measures to show whether it was better, simpler, whether it was valid. So we did a lot of that. Here's a little cartoon of what the eyes do. So the test involved just showing a light on a screen. This is why people with dementia find this task so easy. You see a light on the screen, and all you have to do in this particular test is to look at the light. It couldn't be simpler. And nobody, however severe the dementia, as long as they were feeling well that day, had any difficulties with that. The more difficult test was where we now ask people to move their eyes to the opposite direction to the light. Okay? So you're sitting there, something comes on the screen, and now you have to do what you did, used to do when you're small. You do the opposite of what people tell you to do. So if the light appears to the left, you look to the right. And it's as simple as that. And this, so you're not asked any questions, you don't have to talk, you don't have to explain. That is basically the test we're doing. We get the computer to measure where people are looking very precisely. We get time, we get lots of detailed measurements. We get errors, how often people make mistakes. And even if you tell them till you're blue in the face what they've got to do, some people still make mistakes. And those mistakes tell you about the level of the dementia, the cognitive impairment that people have. So here's results of this test. This is the percentage of errors here. This is our group of patients with Alzheimer's. This is our healthy older people and our young people. And you can see people with Alzheimer's disease make many, many more mistakes on this test where they have to move their eyes away compared to young people. And it's correlated with how demented they are. So the people with more dementia make more mistakes, sorry, this way, and people with less dementia make fewer mistakes, and they're slower. And, well, we did another study, and I think this was one of the reasons why there was so much interest. We wanted to find out whether this test was a problem for everybody with old age disease or just specific to Alzheimer's. So we did the test in people with Parkinson's disease at Preston, actually, Preston Royal Infirmary. We recruited a bunch of people from there. And what you can see, this is zero errors here. Most of patients with Parkinson's disease don't make any errors at all. And the same with people elderly. But people with Alzheimer's do make more errors. So this test, this simple test, we think might be promising way forward. And it has a lot of advantages. So I'll skip on. We did a longitudinal test over 6 months. And we're able to show that people get worse over time. And it picks up problems before traditional tests do. So why might early diagnosis be helpful? Some people think, well, would it actually help you to know 10 years in advance or 5 years in advance whether you're likely to have a problem? Would you want to know? Hands up if you would want to know. Hands up if you wouldn't want to know. Hands up if you're not sure. It's about spit. So some people wouldn't want to know. I don't typically like bad news myself. But a lot of people would want to know. And here's why they would want to know. First of all, if you go to a memory clinic or you go to a GP and you have some worrying signs of dementia, it's not clear what is causing that. And it may be something that's causing it that can be reversible. So for example, if you're going through a period of depression, your thinking skills can go down. And it may be to do with the fact that you've had a recent bereavement. And it may not be that you've got Alzheimer's. It's just that you're going through a bad time right now. And you're not thinking clearly. And that you're forgetting. And it's not Alzheimer's. It's something else. And once your depression is treated, your memory comes back. So it's useful to know whether it's really a serious dementia or not. And there are other causes that can be reversed. So telling people that they're fine and they don't need to worry, I think can be really helpful. But another important reason why people say early diagnosis is useful is because David Alsop and many other people are working flat out to develop new anti-dementia drugs. There's going to come a point where we have a treatment that's really beneficial, but it will not work effectively if we cannot detect people as early as possible. If our tests only pick people up very late, the treatments are going to have limited effect. So the sooner we can detect things, the better it is. And the alternatives are not great for the reasons I alluded to before. So, just to move on to the final part of what I have to say before you go for tea and coffee and cake. The things that I'm thinking about at the moment, because we haven't looked across other cultures, well, at the moment the research has only been done on mainly Caucasian folk. Oh, just bear with me, I pressed the wrong button. What we want to do now is we want to test people, Afro-Caribbean people. We want to do some research with Asian and Chinese, because thought to be very, very useful, the test is going to be have to be shown to be valid across other cultures. So we need tests that are not just going to be used on a particular narrow section of the population. Sorry about this. It's complicated. PowerPoint. So that's one of the next steps that we want to do. If at the end of the presentation, the evening, there's some, if you are interested in further information and would like to consider, well, you like further information, or you know of people who might be interested in volunteering as a healthy participant, because we need both people with who are healthy and people perhaps who are, have a worried about their memories to take part in this research. The more people that take part, the more valid are the results. And I think this is the way we are trying to fight back. We're trying to, but we have to validate these tools at the moment. We're in the very early stages of our research, and we need to increase our participant pool to be able to demonstrate whether or not this data can be useful. So at the back, there will be some sign up sheets if you want to take part. We've been in some care homes. This lady is an absolute star. She's the oldest participant that's taken part in our research. She's 94. And I said, at the end, she did so well. I said, can I take your photo? And she said, yes, as long as you tell the care home manager, because they always say I'm a bit thick. But she was the best participant we've ever had. And she's an example of the 5 in 6, you know, the who doing well, that we want to find out, well, why is it that a 94-year-old can sail through all the memory tests we gave her? And maybe some 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds are struggling. So she can see the smile, she's crying. She's really proud of her achievement. So we gave her a lot of positive feedback. She was really excited about that. There's a lot of hope for the future. Lots of people give negative information, but there's a lot of hope for the future. This is a study I want to tell you very briefly about, for those of you that are interested in golf. This is a study where the researchers asked a group of people between the age of 40 to 60, so these are older, middle-aged people, if you like, to imagine a certain type of golf swing. So they just sat there and they had to think it through in their minds. Imagine. So they were told how to swing the golf club, and then they were to rehearse it mentally. And this was the brain scan before they did the training. And then after the training, they did the brain scan again, and they found some physiological changes, physical structural changes in the brain of these 40 to 60-year-olds. Now, what's exciting about that is that for years, people had thought that the brain was fixed at a certain age and certainly couldn't learn or develop new cells to do with learning at around 60. But now there's increasing evidence that our brains are not fixed. They're flexible, and you can learn new things into your 60s. And this can be picked up in brain scans. This week, some of my own students have done some research, and for the first time, showing that you can, with your eyes, there's a way in which you can improve memory, your memory for words. In both, it had been shown with young people, but it had never been shown with older people. And we've just, well, I need to read the manuscript in a bit more detail, but my students tell me it works just as well with older people. So they got some volunteers from Lancaster. We've got 70 older people, 70 younger people, and you can improve your memory into old age. So when I told my wife this, she said, "What's the technique? What's the technique? Tell me." I haven't told her yet. So if we need, obviously, to validate this, if it's really true, I might try and get it published or maybe do further work. But if it's true, it means there is a lot of hope well into old age. You're not fixed. What about Alzheimer's disease? A lot of people think that the consensus is that in Alzheimer's disease, it's actually, that's it. They don't even bother rehabilitation or cognitive learning strategies in Alzheimer's disease. But we have found, and this is unpublished, that, I won't go into detail, this is our Alzheimer's patients, and this is them testing healthy people and Alzheimer's people on a task over 18 months. And these are increases in speed of response, so down to zero here. Our elderly controls got faster, but also our patients with Alzheimer's disease also got faster on the task. They got better. They improved over 6 months. And this is an increase in learning. So even people with dementia, it's not true to say that they can't learn new things or improve with practice. We have some evidence that they can. So it isn't all doom and gloom, okay? There is scope for improvement. How can you help in research? Well, if you're interested in helping with the eye tracking research, there's some sign-up forms. You can help. It takes 25 minutes for part one, 25 minutes for part two. Here are some volunteers, again, from some care homes we've been in Morecambe. These are two proud sisters showing their jigsaw that they've made, which looks like a painting. But we said, "Can I take a photo of your jigsaw?" And she said, "As long as you get my sister in, because she did all the hard work." So it's a lot of fun, and people actually enjoy. We're not scary, are we? We have a good time with the older folks. I've got two of my researchers here, by the way. That's why I keep looking for them, checking I'm saying the right thing. If you want to find out more, if you know somebody with dementia, you're worried about it, you want to find out things, there are things that I certainly haven't had time to cover. There's an information desk with information from the local Alzheimer's Society in Preston. So we have an Alzheimer's Society in Preston. Jackie's on the desk. Jackie, are you around? Jackie here will be by the desk. She's got lots of information. She can put you in touch with some very helpful, understanding people. I downloaded this really, really useful guide from the Alzheimer's Society website. I'm a member of the National Alzheimer's Society Grant Advisory Board. So every so often I go to London, I meet with the organizers of the Alzheimer's Society, and we try to support research as much as we can. And they produce, their website is fantastic, and they've got lots of useful information that's free to download. So nobody has an excuse of not going and finding out more information to help. There's a lot of help and information and support out there. I'm going to end with some tips. I think I've got 1 minute left. I'm going to end with some tips that I picked up from a conference that I went to in Puerto Rico on Alzheimer's disease early this year. At that conference, there was one session which was the most inspiring session I have ever been to in my life at a conference. It was a session where every speaker was someone who had a dementia. Every speaker had a diagnosis. It was specifically, so you got to hear from people who have a disorder, dementia or whatever, forms of dementia. And you might think, that's impossible. How can you speak at an international conference if you've got a dementia? Well, here were six speakers, all with dementia, telling us how to fight back against this disease. And there were some things that they said which I've written down I mean, some are obvious, which I just meant, you know, if you're worried, the first thing you need to do is see your GP. But you should definitely not struggle on your own. Some of us have private worries, and we're thinking, gosh, like, for example, I've had a bad week memory-wise. I've had a really bad week. And I'm wondering whether I should do the test on myself. Well, the one thing you shouldn't do is sort of lock yourself privately into your own world and struggle on your own. Particularly if you're a carer, if you're worried about your spouse, don't worry and lock yourself away privately. The things you need to do, you know, contacting the AD Society is one. One of the things that they all said was very useful is there are a lot of social media groups out there specifically for people with dementia. So these are social media groups that people with dementia set up, and they share their experience. And quite often they learn more from each other than they would from your GP or your memory clinic. So there are a lot of social media groups out there where you can share your experience and support each other. So that's one thing that a lot of them do. That you can, if you're a carer and you want to help somebody with boost their self-esteem if they're feeling down, one strategy I use with my mum very often, when I used to see my mum in a care home in Leeds, there's no point me asking her, you know, what happened last week, how's so-and-so doing? So what I started doing was just talking to her about things that happened 25, 34, 30, 40 years ago, getting her to talk through her experience as a child, and she loved it. And she suddenly, a mood came up, and she was, instead of feeling sorry for herself and being angry and annoyed because her memory of 35 years ago was fresh, we had a really positive time together. So work on their strengths, not their weaknesses. And also, be prepared to think that, you know, you might be able to help somebody. What you're going through now, or what your relative's going through now, you may be able to help some person who's in your shoes in a few years' time. So try to capitalize on your personal experience. And there's a whole host of things I won't dwell on. Mind mapping, music. People are really, often people, you know, can't remember, still remember songs from 20, 30, 40 years ago. Blogging, speech therapy, laughter. Try and laugh as much as possible. They found that useful. Keep your love relationships. I don't mean your love life, your friendships going, reading, volunteering, charity work. A whole host of things came out of that conference. So I need to say thank you to a lot of people who's helped us in our research. But if you do want further information, there's stuff out there. My time is up. So I want to thank you for your attention and hope that some of that was useful. Thank you very much. I guess just before Sue goes, I ought to give, if anybody got a burning question, then I'll prepare to take that or refer it on. Yeah, there's a hand there. Sorry, I can't remember your name.
Yeah, thank you for giving me the chance to ask this question. At the beginning of your lecture, you mentioned schizophrenia.
Yes.
And the fact that was early onset as against Alzheimer's, which was older onset disease. So is that mean, do you infer from that Alzheimer's is in fact a mental illness?
Is Alzheimer's a mental illness? Alzheimer's disease is unique in a sense. In schizophrenia, we have no idea what the triggering pathology is, which is why it's called, a functional psychological disorder. We don't know. I mean, if you do group scans, you can find different parts of the brain that don't work. But we don't know what the biochemical or physiological cause of schizophrenia is. We have no idea. In Alzheimer's disease, we've known for many years that this beta-amyloid plaque and these neurofibrillary tangles that cause physical changes in the brain and prevent the passing of information from parts of the neurons to each other are affected. And that happens in every person, as far as we know, with Alzheimer's. So there's a real hard physiological, pathological component to Alzheimer's disease that's not true of schizophrenia. So there's a big difference between the two. And so pharmaceutical companies have got a target to aim at in Alzheimer's disease, which is why a lot of people are still optimistic. We know what we need to tackle. We know what we need to stop. In schizophrenia, it's a lot worse, I'm afraid. And the psychiatrist I talk to, you know, I've worked on schizophrenia for many, many, many years, and I've gone to a lot of conferences, and I've seen their mood swings. Psychiatrists do have mood swings, and scientists mood swings. And then there's a lot of deep, if you like, scientists are very down about schizophrenia because they've not made any real progress. There are no real medications that cure the disease. And there's nothing serious on the horizons. And pharmaceutical companies are getting depressed about it as well because they've pumped billions into trying to find true treatments. Nothing cures schizophrenia that we know of. In Alzheimer's disease, it's very different. There's much more optimism because we've got these specific targets, these proteins, these abnormal proteins or aggregation. We know what the processes are, and we've got something we can actually get a handle on. So there's a lot more, if you like, scientific optimism about curing and reversing and slowing down Alzheimer's disease than, sadly, schizophrenia. There's another question, I think.
I was just wondering if, for example, I would like to volunteer because my husband died of Alzheimer's, I would like to volunteer to take part, but I'm not sure at the moment whether I actually want the results.
Okay, that's a really good question. And, you know, I understand that fear. So, for example, my next-door neighbour goes to a church. And she's a wonderful lady. And she said, with a lot of older people in my church, I'll tell them about your research, and hopefully you'll get some volunteers. Not one person from her church volunteered. And do you know why? Because they said exactly what you did. We don't want to know. But the thing, what she didn't make clear is that these eye tests are not diagnostic tests. They're not valid. They're not confirmed tests that predict very, very reliably whether you have Alzheimer's or not. We're still in the research phase where we're just collecting information, and then we, you know, hopefully at some point in the future, we'll be able to develop the best test possible to determine, you know, your prognosis. They're not, so it's not like you're going to GPs and we do a diagnosis. You've got Alzheimer's disease, sorry, bye, you know, you haven't. It's not a diagnostic test. In fact, we don't, you know, people do poorly. So, for example, if you do poor on our tests, it could, and this is a worry with students, if you come to our tests when you've had too much alcohol the night before, you'll not do very well. If you're tired and you've had a bad night's sleep, you'll not do great, and so on. So there are lots of other things that can cause bad performance. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't mean that you've got a diagnosis. So you'd still be very welcome. Catherine.
You mentioned before exercise. Everyone laughs, but it sounds like something. How do you know that that helps people perhaps not get Alzheimer's or something?
Okay.
What do you mean by exercise? Do you mean just generally not slobbing out in front of the telly?
Right.
Or do you mean actually going crazy at the gym? Do you know what I mean? Because there's a big difference when people are frightened of too much exercise.
So we've got a question here. How do we know that exercise is helpful, and what do we mean by exercise? I've never known. There are a few things that there are huge consensus about, but there is a huge consensus. And I just, that conference that I went to in the Windermere last week has found further evidence of exercise. So much so that this morning I thought about going for a run. And that, it takes a lot to get me to go for a run. There's an absolute consensus that one of the best things you can do for your brain, let alone anything else, let alone for your mood, is aerobic exercise. So get your heart rate up, because it improves the cardiovascular system. So you get your heart rate up, you pump more blood to the brain. The brain gets fed by glucose and oxygen, which it needs to survive. So that's just basic physiology to keep your cardiovascular system healthy. So it's non-pharmacologically speaking, taking a drug is probably the best thing you can do. But it also has other spin-off effects that I heard, and women pick up on this. I heard this week at a research conference that aerobic exercise is really good for improving sleep quality and really good for reducing problems with snoring. They're all looking at their husbands. So if that doesn't get you running, I don't know what will. I think there was another question. It's the same question. Sorry, Steve, do you want to add anything about cardiovascular success? We've got GPs in the audience who know, and nurses who know a lot more about this than me.
No, you've been talking about dementia and specifically Alzheimer's.
Yes.
My mother, we believe, is at the early stages of vascular dementia. And what I'm trying
to... Has she had a stroke?
No, she's... she's just starting to lose her memory quite a bit at the moment. But what I'm trying to understand is, does this research that you're doing and the chemistry of the brain that you've been showing actually have any bearing on vascular? Is that something totally different?
That's interesting. It's a really interesting question. In our research, we've been focusing on Alzheimer's disease, but we've very recently we had two participants come to see us, two patients, if you like, one who had Alzheimer's diagnosis and one who had vascular dementia, and we saw some very exciting differences between the two people. Which we may push forward, and I may, if this turns out to be consistent, I may apply to the Alzheimer's Society for some research funding to look at that in more detail. I mean, one of the things, vascular dementia obviously is treated and considered differently to Alzheimer's, and I understand a lot of the Alzheimer's disease drugs are not effective in vascular disease, but I would, you know, encourage you to get a clear diagnosis on that, so you know where you are. And one of the things that you can do earlier on that we're encouraging people is, apart from, if you don't like the idea of aerobic exercise, cognitive stimulation is very good. So word searches, crosswords, the sort of things we should be doing all the time. I'm not saying that will stop it, but for us who are a bit pre-diagnosis stage, keep your mind healthy as far as possible. Hi, Catherine.
You implied when you were talking about who was eligible for the research that all of our eyes move, therefore we were all eligible to do this test. Does it exclude anyone, like for example, macular degeneration, cataracts, or does it rely on being able to see?
Yeah, that's a good, really sense. Good question, Catherine. Well, first I should say, we've been principally interested in people between the ages of 55 and 90. So most of our research, we need older, mature, wise people to take part. But actually, because we're interested in general effects of aging, we do want young people as well below the age of 55 to take part. That's just something I didn't. We check for vision, so we check visual acuity, we check color vision, because you have to be able to see the screen to be able to take part. So we sort of do those. We have a sort of screening exclusion criteria of certain types of things. So if you've got diabetes that affects your vision, so that you can't pass the Snellen test, then you might not be able to take part. So that's true. And obviously, if you're blind, unfortunately, you can't take part in this research. Yeah, so it's a really good question.
Could a head scan help in any way to help with the eyes at the same time or anything like that?
A brain scan?
Yes, because my husband had a scan after they thought it might be a stroke, but he also had Alzheimer's. And... I did wonder if they're connected in any way.
Right. Well, we certainly, in this research that we reported, all our patients had brain scans because we wanted to rule out some underlying brain trauma or brain lesion that might give, because different parts of the brain control different eye systems. So it's really important that, you know, patients don't have, you know, small tumours or infarcts and stuff that might affect the eyes. So we have done that in the past. And we've also done studies that look at the relationship between brain function measured on brain scans and the eyes. So we have to be careful to certainly make sure that people don't have some other problem, you know, that might confound your results. I don't know if that helps. Okie doke, I think everybody's been listening to me long enough. Sue, would you like to come and wind up for us?
Well, I'm sure you've all enjoyed that. I feel that there should be one of these sort of warnings, like when you watch Crime Watch on the television, please don't, you know, have sleepless nights. Don't all go home thinking this is it because you forgot something this morning. But Alzheimer's is on the increase. We do all seem to know a family member, a work colleague, people we know are struggling and affected by Alzheimer's. So if you can, in any way, help with this research, you will see there are these forms out in the foyer. Many of you have already filled them in, and they ask if you would like to be involved in the research, if you would like to receive the information just to tell you about the research, or if you would like to know about future events similar to the one we've had this afternoon. So please do fill those in and get all your details down so that we can contact you. There are also some little pieces of paper with the website address on if you want to take those with you as well. Do stay behind, join us for a cup of tea, a coffee and a biscuit, but also chat with each other as well. Maybe you've got your own experiences, your own fears, your worries. Use this time to network with each other and to talk to each other. But just before we go for a drink, I'd just like to again say thank you very much to Trevor for the input he's given this afternoon, and hopefully you've all enjoyed that. So thank you, Trevor.